Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby.
Today we ask the question, is there any folk music left to be discovered in our digital world? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and maybe there's a lot of folk music to be mined in the history of the U.S. presidents. We'll meet later today three songwriters who've written a collection of songs commemorating each of the 43 commanders-in-chief. But first, 60 years ago, a man named Moses Ash set out with an ambitious mission to catalog all of the sounds in the world. With his label, Folkways Records, he released about 2,200 albums over 40 years, featuring everybody from Woody Guthrie, whom we're hearing now, to the sound of the bottlenose dolphin. Upon his death, Ash's archives were acquired by the Smithsonian, and Smithsonian Folkways continues his legacy today. In a moment, we'll talk to a writer from the New Yorker magazine about an independent label that's doing much the same thing in Georgia. But first, let me introduce Richard Carlin. He is author of Worlds of Sound, The Story of Smithsonian Folkways. Richard, welcome.
Thanks.
So why would you care enough about a record label to write a book about it? And why do we care enough to actually read it? What is the story? What is so compelling about Folkways?
I think that the story is... it's a combination of many things. It's a culture story, it's a music story, it's a business story, and it's the story of one man, as I like to say, on a mission from God. He really was determined to document as much as possible the soundscape in which he lived. And for him, he had incredibly open ears. He was interested in everything. So he was willing to issue not one, but five records of steam locomotive whistles. You know, not just one record from Africa, but hundreds of records. In fact, I remember once being at the offices and Mo saying to me, "This last record from Ghana sold 20 copies. Now I'm putting out another." And nothing made him happier than a record that didn't sell. And so it was all part of what he called a mosaic. He was trying to put together a picture of his times in sound. And
how much of that picture did he have in mind on day one? I mean, you know, the name Folkways implies that he had something a little more specific in mind at the beginning.
Well, yes and no. He told a story, and there's no way of verifying this, but he claimed that one of the first recording jobs he was working for radio station WEVD, which stood for Eugene V. Debs. Some of your listeners may remember it. It was broadcast in the city. And he was assigned to record Einstein giving a statement to the Jews of the world. This was right before World War II.
EVD was the station, before my time, but didn't they broadcast a lot of Yiddish programs
That's correct. They were owned by the Forward, which was a Yiddish newspaper.
The Yiddish newspaper, right.
Right. Okay. And so Mo went to record Einstein, and the way he told the story, Einstein said to him, "Young man, what are you interested in?" And Mo apparently said, "Well, I'm a radio engineer, and I'd like to record, you know, the world of sound around me." And Einstein supposedly said, "What a great idea! You know, go forth and do this." And so Mo would always justify his mission by citing this original encounter. Although sometimes he would substitute other names for Einstein, which made it a tad suspicious. But there you are. And even in his very early releases, from day one, he was doing stuff that most people wouldn't consider "quote unquote" folk music.
Well, but he also was doing things that would come to actually define folk music for many Americans. Among them, this early recording by Leadbelly doing the Midnight Special.
Same
Midnight Special by Lead Belly, recorded by Mo Ash, the founder of the Folkways record label back in the mid-20th century. And we're speaking at the moment with Richard Carlin, who used to work as an independent producer for Folkways Records and is author of the book Worlds of Sound, The Story of Smithsonian Folkways.
Today on the Soundcheck blog...
Folkways Records did many things, but chief among them was proving that Big Bill Brunsey was right. "They're all folk songs," Brunsey once said. "I ain't never heard a horse sing."
For the rest of the story, go to the Soundcheck blog at WNYC.org.
And while you're there, you can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page, WNYC.org. Richard, you've already alluded to the fact that he very quickly... went beyond what we would normally consider folk music.
Right.
It sort of raises the question that Big Bill Brunsey, and this quote has been attributed to many other people as well,
right?
The idea, what is folk music?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always irritating for people that are interested in folk or traditional music when the New York Times or some newspaper goes, "Revival of folk music," and it's always about someone like Joan Baez playing a concert somewhere, as if you don't have long hair and strum a guitar and sing socially conscious music, you're not a folk musician. I think how I define folk music is sort of much more broadly as sort of non-professional music, if you want to think about it that way. Music that people make for their own entertainment. For example,
Lead Belly was a professional.
No, yes, and Lead Belly was. I mean, there are all kinds of contradictions that occur when you try to pin this down.
Right, right.
But, for example, I recorded some Irish musicians who played in their basement in Cleveland, and Mo put these out on several discs. And at the time, people were much more interested in the Chieftains or the Boys of the Lock, this kind of highly polished performance. And I'll never forget the first review I got. The guy said, "Well, this isn't really very good. It sounds like something somebody recorded in their basement." And, that, I was like, yes, that's exactly right.
Bingo.
So, bingo. And so there's always this tension, between performance and what that means and what does it mean to be a professional performer. I mean, Lead Belly's records for Mo, I actually found the royalty slips, and they, he sold 40 records through in 1942. So he wasn't like top of the charts.
Right, right.
Exactly, either.
But despite that, Ash kept going with Folkways,
right.
And as you say, very quickly got beyond the confines of even American music. For example,
right.
the drumming of the Maroons of Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
What got him interested in going beyond the borders?
Ash was very fortunate in that he was very open to eccentric collaborators. And one of the first people that he befriended was Harold Corlander. And Harold had recorded in Haiti in the 40s using a disc cutting machine. Actually, it was against the law for this drumming to occur at the time. So he had to get a permit to record this drumming.
In Haiti.
Okay. Because it was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he said he started at this hotel room and he had the help coming in, and then the help would invite their cousins and their nephews, and all of a sudden all these people were coming down from the hills to play this music. And eventually he was shut down, mm-hmm. even though he had a permit.
And what about this Jamaican drumming that we're hearing?
Well, the Maroons were recorded by a young guy named Ken Bilby. At the time, he was a high school student. And his grandmother lived in Jamaica, and he had a Sony stereo cassette machine. And he said to me, "I just made these tapes, brought them up to Mo." And Mo said, "I'll put them out." But he didn't realize that Mo didn't really clean up the tapes. So some of the tracks, actually, you can hear the cassette machine coming to speed at the beginning of the track.
Uh-huh.
But for Mo, that's all part of the document, you see? So that opening sound was okay as far as he was concerned.
And it was, I'm sure, almost anybody who heard it, the first time they had heard this drumming from the Maroons of Jamaica. Called Wawi Gwindu from the Worlds of Sound sampler that comes with the book Worlds of Sound, The Story of Smithsonian Folkways by my guest Richard Carlin. Joining us as well is Burkhardt Bilger, staff writer at The New Yorker, who wrote a story on the search for folk music for that magazine's April 28th issue entitled The Last Verse, Is There Any Folk Music Still Out There? And Burkhart, anyone who read your article would come away from that with a big yes as the answer to the title.
Absolutely.
But again, as Richard was just saying, what folk music is very much still in play as a question. Your article follows the story of the guys behind this record label Dust to Digital, who are based in Georgia. Do you see them as kind of, you know, carrying out the mission, the tradition of Moses Ash and Folkways?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, their notion is that a lot of this material has kind of just languished in archives and is forgotten. And especially, I think the most influential thing that Mo did was the Harry Smith Anthology of American Folk Music. And that's what Dust to Digital has been focused on, too. And that's music really from a very short period in American history, from about 1923 to 1933, that's considered kind of the golden age of American folk music. And that stuff is a wonderful moment in American music because radio hasn't gone all over the country yet. Everybody hasn't heard each other. And there are these little pockets of kind of original music making. And it was a time when that line between professional and home musician wasn't so strict. I mean, some of these people were absolutely unbelievable musicians. They were as good as, or better than professionals are today, and yet they were just people who sang at fish fries and so forth. And so those recordings from before radio became prevalent got collected in the Harry Smith Anthology, and they have kind of sparked revivals of that early folk music again and again in our history since then.
Yeah, it's funny how that's become kind of a repeating touchstone for a lot of generations of rockers and, you know, contemporary folk musicians.
Seems like every time it gets re-released in a new format or when Smithsonian re-released it in 1996, boom, suddenly bands like Arcade Fire or Radiohead, all these kind of listen to this music again and go, wow, there's something here.
Right. So what is the market for this kind of music? I mean, clearly Richard Smithsonian continues the work of Moses Ash and continues Folkways as a brand.
Right.
Are they selling more than 40 copies of a record these days?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Tony Seeger, the first director of the archive, had the foresight to digitize everything very early on. So you can go to their website, which I'm supposed to shamelessly plug, which is folkways.si.edu, and you can download any of the thousands of tracks that were commercially issued, including the Harry Smith Anthology. But then again, in a wonderfully perverse way, they've continued the mission of Mo. They did a 20 CD set of Indonesian music and purposely left gamelan off, left off the best known music because they figured somebody else has already done that. But that's the antithesis of commercial thinking, right? You put out the music no one's heard of and hope that that might sell. And so I mean,
if you look at Nielsen,
Dust to Digital is the same kind of way.
Yeah, and the numbers are very, very small. I mean, the best thing or the most well-sold anthology of the Dust to Digital put out was called Goodbye Babylon, which was nominated for a Grammy and had a huge impact. It sold, I think, about 8,000 copies.
Yeah, but each of those cost $100.
So each cost $100, and they had
got cotton with each one.
we should say it was packed in a wooden case,
in a cedar kind of slip case, wooden case with
cotton, raw cotton,
and from Lance Ledbetter, the owner of Dust to Digital, from his uncle's farm. So it was very much.
So it was like
operation.
An artifact in addition to being a set of recordings.
Yeah.
But what about, I mean, you know, as Richard's saying, Smithsonian has digitized all the Folkways stuff. Ironically, Dust to Digital, as near as we can tell, doesn't have much of a digital presence on the web.
No, it doesn't. I mean, I think part of what happens with a lot of this music is it's not clear who owns them. I mean, I think with Smithsonian that may have been solved, but a lot of times the best recordings of certain old folk songs now belong, in a sense, to the people who did the noise reduction on them.
All right, now that's something we can come back to in a bit because that opens up a whole nother can of worms. But let's hear a little bit from this record label Dust to Digital from a CD compilation called Art of Field Recording. This is a youngster named Ray Rhodes singing an old song called Fred Adams.
Come and listen to a story we can tell. A story of Fred Adams, a boy we all know well. He started out to drinking, he made a very bad man. He robbed the filling station, he shot a marshal down. Fred Adams went to Arkansas, took to the Kennett jail. The jury found him guilty and locked him in the cell. His sister came to see him. She tried to beg the truth. I did not shoot the marshal down, he said to his sister Ruth. His sweetheart came to see him. She stayed with him before.
Fred Adams is the name of the song. Ray Rhodes is the singer, recorded in Michigan in 1958 from Art of Field Recording, Volume 1, recorded by Art Rosenbaum and compiled and released on this Dust to Digital label. And we're speaking with Richard Carlin, author of the book Worlds of Sound, about the Folkways label, and Burkhardt Bilger from The New Yorker, who wrote a lengthy article called The Last Verse, Is There Any Folk Music Still Out There?, which talked a bit about Dust to Digital. Richard, you were just telling me while we were listening to that that Art Rosenbaum recorded four Folkways early in his career.
Yeah, actually, when he was 17 years old, he and a friend of his rediscovered a banjo player named Pete Steele, who had recorded for the Library of Congress in the 30s. Art grew up in the Indianapolis area, and Pete Steele lived nearby in Ohio. And they just lugged a big tape recorder over and recorded him and sent the tape to Mo, and Mo put it out.
All right, so there are clearly challenges in finding this music, especially, you know, back in the day when tape recorders were big, heavy, unwieldy things. There are also challenges to us as listeners in finding and then actually listening to some of these recordings, and we'll talk about that in a moment as well. Here's a little bit more from Dust to Digital, and this is from that beautiful wooden box set we were talking about called Goodbye Babylon. Sister O.M. Terrell is the singer, and then we'll continue more of our conversation with Richard Carlin and Burkhardt Bilger.
Somebody wrong, God knows you're wrong. I know the Bible right. Somebody wrong, Bible right. Know the Bible right. Well, 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 you're wrong. Tell you once, tell you twice.
The Bible's Right by Sister O.M. Terrell. More in a moment, and coming up a bit later on in the program, we'll look at an epic collection of 43 songs, each one about a different U.S. president. That's coming up later. You're listening to Soundcheck.
Of everything in our situation will serve to establish a precedent.
Today the Savior rose. Our Jesus left the dead.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Welcome back. We're discussing the search for folk music then and now. With me in the studio are Richard Carlin, author of Worlds of Sound, The Story of Smithsonian Folkways, and Burkhardt Bilger, staff writer at The New Yorker, who wrote earlier this year about the independent folk label Dust to Digital, based in Atlanta, Georgia. This is, again, from one of their recordings. And Burkhardt, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times already that that folk music is a very, very difficult thing to define. This piece that we're hearing in the background, an example of what they call a lined-out hymn, this is prayer. How does this become folk music when this is a congregation of Southern Baptists singing?
Well,
singing a hymn.
Right. I mean, Rosenbaum's own definition of folk music is that it's something that has to be transmitted orally by a relative or someone you've grown up with. And he talks about the difference between folk musicians and singers of folk music. And one is something you've learned at home, and the other is you learned off the record. Of course, that line is also murky because Robert Johnson, a lot of these guys learned stuff off records already. So it's impossible really to make absolute definitions in this case.
And how many folk musicians actually learned from records of people like Robert Johnson and Charlie Patton?
Of course, yeah, the whole thing breaks down at a certain point. But I do think there's a that through line is something worth preserving, and it's something when you look at folk musicians today, it's getting lost a little bit, that oral tradition.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Richard was talking before about Moash and Smithsonian at Folkways, you know, with the sound of the tape getting up to speed, left on the record because it was part of the document. How much is the context within which these performances take place? How important is that to sort of giving you the real sense of this music?
Well, I mean, some of the greatest folk records we have very little context. I mean, those old Robert Johnson records don't have anything like that, though occasionally you'll hear like a trolley bell from below on the street in Memphis at the Peabody Hotel, but most of the time it's pretty clean. But when you do get it in a nice way, like on that Rosenbaum collection, it can be wonderfully atmospheric. I mean, the sound of chickens in the background or somebody playing pool or that kind of thing really adds to it.
Or the John Henry cut where you hear them chopping the wood as it's happening. Or for Folkways, the Pete Seeger concerts where you hear the subway going by.
That was his context.
Right. Exactly.
For Margaret Kimmett, in the song 20 Froggies Go to School, her context is apparently quite different. Take a listen to this.
20 little coats of green, 20 vests all white and clean. We must be in time, said they. First we study, then we play. That is how we keep the rules when we froggies go to school. Master Bullfrog Graven.
20 froggies go to school. So Margaret Kimmett is singing. In the background, the pool balls are being racked up for another game of pool. Yeah. You hear the cash register. She's in a bar.
She's in a bar and in Dallas City, Illinois, a little river town. And Rosenbaum shows up at the bar with his reel-to-reel. Sits down next to this fairly cranky old lady, in her 70s, and starts asking her about it and has her sing Frankie and Johnny. That's on the record, too. And then he says, you know any other songs you know, Froggy Went to Court? And she's like, no, I don't know that song, you know. And and then she starts singing this weird old song about frogs going to school. It's wonderful to kind of hear the whole process go thread itself out.
Now, Burkhardt, you mentioned before the thorny issue of copyright, of you know, sound, improving the sound of these things. What do you gain? What do you lose when you do sound enhancement and digitization of these rough old field recordings?
Well, I remember buying my first compilations and reissues in the late 80s, early 90s, and they had names like the sound reduction things had names like earwax and so forth, and it really sounded like it. I mean, they took these records and basically would boost them up so high that the noise would turn beyond this ability for the ear to hear it, and then they would boost it back down and you would lose that. But the problem was you lose a lot of other stuff as well. You lose the clinking of the guitar pick on the string. You lose some of the atmosphere of the voice. So when it's done poorly, it can really take the soul out of a song. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, they've gotten much, much better at that kind of thing. There's some really sophisticated algorithms from Cambridge University that are used to really, I mean, you look at this stuff, they'll take a sound wave and magnify a millisecond up to a few inches on a computer screen, and they can just go in and selectively excise the one little point where there's a pop on the record. Mm-hmm. And you really can't hear that when you go back down to the regular sound wave.
So do you lose anything in with the current technology?
Well, it depends on what you're going to do. If you can take out certain things, pops and scratches are easy to take out, and you don't lose anything, really. But as soon as you take out something like hiss, which is something that is kind of broadband and threaded throughout, it gets very difficult. And really doing that completely, there's almost no way.
All right. Now, we took this off of your podcast of this group from the Congo called Grupo de Totoko Francois and a song called Bololo Okilolo. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yep.
And if not, close enough for us. let's hear a little bit of what the original sounds like with all the snap, crackle, and pop on it. All right, so it's a little glitchy, a little scratchy. Now, here's the same song cleaned up through modern technology. So what do you think, Burkhardt? Is something lost there, even though the sound is so much clearer?
I tell you what, when I first heard that A-B comparison, I was in the basement of the sound engineer who did that noise reduction. And he played me four or five different cuts like that and was very proud of what he'd done. And I said, you know what? I have to tell you, I like that the original version better with the noise. And he said, well, you know, that's just psychoacoustics. And I said, psychoacoustics? It turns out, and Cambridge Soundworks that did the noise reduction system he used, it did a bunch of blind studies in the late 90s where they would take a clean modern recording and then they would just dub some noise onto it. And then they would take those two recordings and they would play it for a panel of listeners. And invariably, like 9 out of 10 listeners said, you know what, I like the noisy version better. I can hear there's more presence in the voice. It sounds more alive. It's more soulful. And it's just your ear kind of taking those high noisy sounds and interpolating, thinking it's part of the voice, but it's not. So it's very difficult at a certain point to say which is better.
Richard, did Mo Ash ever go in for any of the kind of sound reductions?
Mo was the original. He used to say to me, stereo is a lie. And I would say, well, mono's a lie if the person's not there. And then he would get very, very angry. He believed in flat recording, but you have to understand when Mo was around in the 50s, they brought in something called hi-fi. And that was really an artificial boosting to make it sound better on the crappy cheap home turn, you know, you could get your Mantovani record and it would sound a lot better on home. And Mo fought against this. He was a true believer in sound as document and it should not be altered. There's something different than that than cleaning up a 78 recording, obviously. There, you're talking about a different set of problems. Although, again, it's really hard to say because obviously, at the time, people experienced it with the noise.
Right, and now we have a generation that experiences music through MP3s, which to audiophile ears is equally crappy sound.
Right, exactly.
So let me ask you both a final question, which is, what is the outlook for this kind of music, for this kind of recording, this kind of, you know, musical anthropology in a digital world?
Richard? Well, I think it's both good and bad. It's good in the sense that a lot more people have access now. And I always say when I'm talking to people, you know, you've got an iPod, you can record. Go record your uncle. Go record your family Thanksgiving like Mo did, the sounds of the office. We now know what a 1950s office sounded like. And in a sense, you know, it's kind of a strange territory, you know, with all the typewriters and all the. So why not, you know, there's sound all around you. And technology has become so inexpensive that in a way it's opened things way up if you can hear them and if you're willing to.
And Burkhart, the idea that Dusted Digital, you know, was founded to find all these little pockets of music that hadn't already been infected by all the other pockets of music, everybody now hears everything else. So is there any more folk music, any more of those pockets to be found?
Well, I think what we've had is a proliferation of pockets. I mean, it's all niches now. Everybody on YouTube has their own little version of a song they want to do. I mean, I had this wonderful moment about 6 months ago where my daughter, who's 7, had learned Here Comes the Sun at home in her music class, in which, you know, Here Comes the Sun is kind of a new folk song in a way.
Right.
And she wanted to see it on the computer. I said, well, just go to YouTube and do a search. And within 10 minutes, there was a 70-year-old man in Iowa who had recorded a song of him playing Here Comes the Sun on ukulele, and she and this old man had this wonderful rapport, you know, for on the radio.
We've been talking about the search for folk music through the Folkways records of Moses Ash and now through labels like Dust to Digital. Richard Carlin, a former producer for Folkways, is author of the book Worlds of Sound, The Story of Smithsonian Folkways. Burkhart Bilger is a staff writer at The New Yorker and wrote the story The Last Verse. Is there any folk music still out there? Guys, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
And in the background, Little Red Rooster, the Myers Sisters from a Dust to Digital recording.
Hey, hey, some more folk home. Little Red Rooster, they treat him nice.
They treat him nice.
Little Red Rooster,
they
treat him nice.
Still to come, three songwriters aimed to capture the essence of every American president in a collection of 43 songs. We'll find out what might be in store for their 44th. And we want to know what song you think captures the spirit of democracy. It can be serious, it can be silly. Post your song choice on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org and tune in to Soundcheck tomorrow when we'll sample some of the most inspired choices for democracy songs.
So hard to choose, I'm going away. Hey, hey, something's so long.
There's no way.
There's no
Living in this town.
Living in this town.
There's no maid.
There's no maid.
Living in this town.
Living in this town. There's no maid living in this town. She goes to bed before the sun goes down.